Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shop Till You Drop Dead by Dorothy Howell. Narrated by Tina Wollstonecroft. Chapter 1. I'm not doing it, I said. Bailey gave me serious stink eye and said,
You have to.
I gave her serious stink eye right back. No.
It's on her list, Hollis. She told me. You have to buy them.
I grabbed the elastic waist khaki pants by the hanger and jerked them off the rack.
They're hideous,
I said and shook them at her. I'm not buying them.
They're hideous, all right, she agreed. I'd die if somebody bought those for me.
I'd kill if somebody bought them for me, I told her. And that about summed up the difference between me and my friend Bailey Redding, except for our appearance. I was 5'7" tall, with auburn hair and green eyes. Bailey was a little shorter and wore her blonde hair spiked up. Oh, and Bailey is from around here. I hung the god-awful pants on the rack again. There's only so much I'll do for money.
Yeah? Well, you're the only person in this town who'll say that.
Bailey replied. She pulled the pants off the rack and shoved them into my arms. I knew she was right, and that this was what my life was all about these days. And really, except for rare occasions such as this, I was okay with it. We were in Macy's on Flower Street in Los Angeles, and believe it or not, we were working. If you can define work as spending your days in fabulous stores, shops, and boutiques, shelling out unseemly amounts of other people's money. Both of us were personal shoppers employed by the Fisher Joyce Group, a concierge service housed in a high-rise a few blocks away on Wilshire Boulevard. The firm's motto was, "Almost anything for absolutely anyone," and they meant it. There were experts on staff who could give fashion advice and defend a client on murder charges, and everything in between. Bailey had worked for Fisher Joyce for a while now. I'd gotten this job a few weeks ago. I'm not from around here.
Do you need anything else?
Bailey asked. As you could guess by the elastic waist khaki pants, I wasn't exactly buying for the Beyoncés of the world. I glanced at my cell phone and the list of items my client had ordered today. She was Zella Mason, a screenwriter who'd made her mark in Hollywood back before I was born, and that was 23 years ago. Her sense of style had gone the way of those disaster movies like Earthquake and The Towering Inferno, taking her career along with it. That's it for Zella, I said. No cotton panties with a double-lined crotch?
How about a boxed bra?
Bailey asked. I hate you, I told her. Bailey knew I didn't mean it, but if I really did hate her, I would be justified in doing so. She shopped for what Fisher Joyce had determined were B-list clients, second-tier celebrities, businesswomen and professionals, people who cared about what they looked like and wanted to project a certain image, people who had actual taste and style. My clients were referred to as off-listers, not to their faces, of course. Fading stars, aging industry people, new clients with no pedigree, and most any whack job who stumbled into our office and could pay our outrageous fee. Of course, our clients could always order what they wanted off the internet and have it delivered to their home, or our A-listers could have their personal assistants do their shopping for them. But Fisher Joyce was the hot way to go. Something to oh-so-casually mention at cocktail parties or at the makeup mirror in the ladies' room at gala events. As if those people needed another reason to feel special. Bailey glanced at the t-shirts draped across her arm and consulted the list on her phone. That's it for me. I looked at my phone again for the last item on my shopping list. This one for a different off-lister. I need to stop by the shoe department, I said. We made our way through the lunchtime crowd. Eric, one of the clerks we knew, tall, thin, young, immaculately groomed, saw us coming, gave us a little nod, and disappeared into the stockroom. We followed him in.
Check out these little darlings, he said,
and whipped off the top of a shoebox as if he were a French chef presenting his latest gourmet creation. Inside lay a gorgeous pair of cherry red stilettos from the smoking hot newest designer on the fashion scene. Bailey and I gasped. True, I'm not from around here, but you don't have to be from LA to appreciate an awesome pair of shoes. Eric slammed the lid on the box and glanced around.
Don't breathe a word, he whispered. I don't want a riot to break out.
Eric, like a lot of salespeople at the major department stores, shops, and boutiques in LA, knew what our clients liked as well as we did and held back the hottest items for us, pumping up his commission in the process.
They're perfect for one of my clients. It will be a great surprise for her, Bailey said. I'll take them.
I didn't fight her for the shoes, since Zella was pretty much the fashion trendsetter of my client list. With one exception. Have you got my client's shoes? I asked. Eric knew right away to whom I was referring and pulled the box off of a high shelf. Gloria Wyatt was one of my off-listers. She had a special place in my heart because she was the very first person I'd shopped for when I came on board with Fisher Joyce. If she had more prestige, she'd have been assigned to Bailey or one of the other B-list shoppers. She owned the Glorious Nails chain of nail salons. Her shops were located in strip malls and catered to middle-class clientele, thus relegating her to me as an off-lister. Eric rang up our purchases, and we paid for them using the Fisher Joyce-issued credit cards assigned to each of us. The company was big on accounting. We shoppers had to answer for every dime we spent.
Let me know when you get something awesome in purple, Bailey said as Eric passed us our shopping bags.
He nodded wisely.
For you know who?
Yep, Bailey said. I didn't ask who you know who was because we weren't supposed to name names, both for privacy and to continue the illusion of mystery at Fisher Joyce. But if I asked Bailey, she'd tell me.
I'll call you,
Eric promised. We wound our way out of the shoe department. Are you heading back to the office? I asked.
I've got one quick stop to make,
Bailey said. See you later, I called. I took the escalator down to the parking garage and loaded my packages into the rear of the brand spanking new BMW 5 Series I'd been assigned when I left Fisher Joyce earlier. Driving a cool car while on company business was a perk I hadn't expected when I'd taken the job as personal shopper. Truthfully, this wasn't a job I'd ever aspired to. It wasn't covered on career day at the high school I'd attended in Kansas City, Kansas, or KCK, as we called it. And it certainly wasn't mentioned at the community college where I got my AA. KCK was the younger sibling to Kansas City, Missouri, which had the airport, the baseball and football teams, the convention centers, and everything else that brought people into a city and made them want to stay. So why did I, Hollis Brannigan, leave and end up in Los Angeles several months ago? It was because of my best friend since third grade, Brittany Maxwell. Actually, it was Brittany's boyfriend, Toby. No, really, it was the chick who came on to Toby at the Heroes Bar and Grill and made him forget all about Brittany until she caught them making out in the back hallway next to the ladies' restroom. It wasn't pretty. Brittany decided she'd had it with Toby. They'd dated since they were freshmen in high school, and if his head could be turned that easily when he thought she wasn't looking, well, Brittany said it was time for a change. 2 days later, we were in my Chevy Malibu, headed for the bright lights of Tinseltown. Brittany had been in pageants since she was 3 years old and knew she could make it in Hollywood. And me, well, things being what they were at my house, I was glad to go too. Brittany said that since I was tall, compared to her, I'm a giant, I could easily land a movie deal too, but thought I should dye my auburn hair bright red because she'd noticed that in People magazine, a lot of the young starlets had hair that color. Brittany was my best friend, and I loved her to death, but when it came to giving out advice, I questioned her judgment.
her long-term relationship with that dirtbag Toby being a perfect example. I stuck with Auburn. Brittany and I found an apartment to share and eked out a living working as movie extras, waitresses, and servers for restaurants and catering companies. Things happened, things always happen, and Brittany ended up returning to KCK with Toby. He'd missed her something terrible, or so he claimed in the zillion phone and text messages he'd sent starting the day we left KCK, and finally showed up at our apartment begging Brittany to go back home with him. I guess it was for the best. Brittany's dreams of making it big in Hollywood hadn't materialized, and she wasn't all that crazy about the LA traffic, the crowds, and the glimpses of a lifestyle she'd love to have, but saw no way of getting. If it hadn't been for the night I spent with Bob Seger, I'd have gone with them. Instead, I maxed out my last credit card to buy an awesome business suit at Neiman Marcus so I could apply for the job in the investigations department at Fisher Joyce that I'd heard about from a girl who lived in our apartment building. I'd figured I was a shoe-in for the position in the investigations department. Back in KCK, I'd worked for Beau and Buster's Used Car Emporium. They were my uncles, and no, those weren't their real names. We carried our own paper. That's used car lingo for financing our customers' vehicles ourselves. And ever since I was a sophomore in high school, I'd been doing everything from checking credit to tracking down people who'd skipped out on their payments. So I'd gone to Fisher Joyce in a killer outfit and with what I figured were equally killer credentials, only to be told the position in the investigations department had been filled. Thankfully, my years of reading Cosmo, Elle, Marie Claire, and Mademoiselle magazines while verifying employment, talking to the credit bureau, and hunting down skips paid off. The woman in HR recognized my flair for fashion and offered me the job as a personal shopper. What can I say? I was desperate for a job. A paycheck, really. So I accepted the position, but still had my eye on the investigations department. I left Macy's and drove back to Fisher Joyce and pulled into the underground parking garage. I still had Zella Mason's khaki elastic waist pants and Gloria's shoes to process, but there was nothing else that required my attention this afternoon. I grabbed the Macy's bags out of the back and relinquished the BMW to the valet. I was supposed to head directly to the package prep room in the shipping department, but I spotted Andy Edmond waiting for a car to be brought around for him. He looked thoroughly annoyed. Andy worked in our investigations department. But believe me, nobody would confuse Andy with one of those hot PIs on television. He was really tall and really thin, with light brown hair he was constantly fussing with. His biggest concern in life seemed to be that he would sustain a wrinkle in one of his expensive suits. The general feel for Andy was that he was putting in his time, going through the motions, as he worked his way up the management food chain. Somebody said he was related to the owner, but I think Andy's the one who started that rumor, which was really crappy, except I do kind of wish I'd thought of it myself. If so, maybe I'd be working in the investigations department instead of buying things I couldn't keep. "Hey, Andy," I said and walked over. He tossed back his hair and spared me a look.
"Oh, Hollis. Hi."
Andy was not exactly running over with charm and personality, a failure that, I was sure, would serve him well when he was eventually promoted into a management position. He shuddered.
"I hate this parking garage. The smell is atrocious."
"Heading out on a case?" I asked. Honestly, I couldn't have cared less about Andy, but since he worked in investigations and I wanted to work there too, I figured it wouldn't hurt to let him see my face. Hopefully, he'll have been promoted to another department by the time I get there.
"Yes, unfortunately,"
Andy said and smoothed down his tie. He glared at the attendants in the valet booth.
"I don't know why it takes this long to get a car."
I'm sure the attendants heard him and chose to ignore his comment. just like they surely dragged their feet every time Andy wanted a car. That's what I would have done.
It's just the most ridiculous thing,
he declared and waved the portfolio in his hand.
Some rich bitch in Hancock Park lost her dog.
When Fisher Joyce came up with their motto, almost anything for absolutely anyone, they weren't kidding.
I hate dogs,
Andy said and uttered a disgusted grunt.
I hate cats, too.
Andy hated everything but himself.
They should have hired you in investigations,
Andy said, smoothing his hair back. He shook the portfolio at me.
This is the sort of thing someone like you should be sent out on.
Andy's comment was insulting on many levels, not the least of which was the common knowledge that I wasn't from around here. But he was so self-centered, I was sure it didn't occur to him. Besides, at the moment, I didn't care. I saw an opportunity and jumped on it.
I'll take it for you, I said.
Andy froze, his fingers in mid-swoop through his hair, and looked down at me as if I were a wad of gum he'd just discovered on the sole of his Manolo loafers.
You,
he asked.
Investigate a case?
Sure, I told him, and shrugged to indicate it was no big deal. I go out there, talk to the owner, calm her down, make notes on everything she says, and that's it. I come back here, give you the info, and you turn it over to the techs to follow up. Andy didn't say anything. And in the meantime, you can do whatever you want, I said. Now I had his attention. He pressed his lips together and narrowed his eyes, thinking, I was sure, of all the places he could hang out and not do any actual work. Andy was definitely management material. He looked me up and down, then pursed his lips distastefully.
You'll have to go to wardrobe.
Fisher Joyce had a wardrobe department. The company was even fussier than Andy when it came to appearances. All the employees were required to project the right image when dealing face-to-face with clients, which meant we sometimes got to wear awesome clothes and drive really hot cars from the motor pool. No problem, I said.
And you'll have to hurry,
he said, glancing at my shopping bag.
You can't keep the client waiting.
I'll be on my way in 15 minutes, I said.
That should be fine.
Andy huffed irritably and glared once more at the parking valets.
If somebody could actually get a car up here.
Great, I said, and reached for the portfolio. Andy held it back.
Don't screw this up.
It's a missing dog, I said. What's to screw up? Andy studied me for another few seconds, then handed over the portfolio.
I'll remember this,
he said. I think, hope, he meant that as a compliment. I dashed into the shipping department near the valet booth and into the prep room where our clients' purchases were custom packaged before being hand-delivered in one of the company's vans. Another plus for our clients was that the prestige of a personal shopping service guaranteed their packages were not tossed in with those of the common folk, nor handled by the riffraff of commercial delivery services. Apparently, wealthy, privileged people can't be told often enough just how special they are. I dumped Zella's hideous khaki pants on a work table and folded them between thin sheets of pale blue tissue paper, then placed them inside a gray gift box, both bearing the Fisher Joyce company logo. I printed the purchase receipt that Macy's had emailed to me, along with the delivery label from the computer at the workstation in the corner. I sealed Zella's copy of the receipt inside a gray envelope, along with my business card and a pre-printed thank you note, both with the Fisher Joyce logo on them, then tied the package with a wide navy blue ribbon and handed it off to the guy in the shipping department. All for a pair of elastic waist khaki pants. That's Hollywood. I did the same for Gloria's shoes, then took the elevator up to the 6th floor and went through the double doors into the Fisher Joyce reception area. It was sleek, contemporary, with stainless steel, gray marble, and white furniture. I gave the two receptionists a little wave as I passed by. They were women in their 40s, the age where they still looked great but were old enough to not take any crap from someone who showed up without an appointment. Sometimes, if the lobby was empty and the phones were quiet, they'd chat with me, which I appreciated since I was still kind of new here. But I didn't have time for small talk today. Andy had agreed to let me take a case, my shot at making inroads into the investigations department, and I didn't have a minute to spare. Not that I need much time once I got to the client's house. All I had to do was make a few sympathetic noises and jot down the info about the missing dog. What could be easier? Chapter 2. The wardrobe department always looked as if a clothing bomb had gone off in there. What must have been hundreds of garments hung from racks that took up most of the floor space. There were walls of shoes, handbags, and hats, plus drawers filled with accessories and jewelry. Closets held the private clothing collections that belonged to the company's upper management. I guess you never knew when you might have to throw on an Armani tux or a Versace gown and swing by a gala event. Wardrobe employees dressed in extreme outfits and sported edgy hairstyles. In Hollywood, this was called fashion forward. In KCK, it would have been called Halloween. The place was always crazy busy with a half dozen employees moving garments around, styling personnel heading out on company business, talking with designers on their phones, interviewing clients, or running up something on a sewing machine. One of them was the friend of my neighbor who'd told me about the job here. She spotted me as soon as I walked through the door. "Hollis, what's up?" Moss called. Yes, everyone called her Moss, but I doubted it was her real name. Although making up a new name seemed to be the norm for wardrobe people, since two of the other girls who worked there were called Triplet and Flute. Moss was super cool, and like all the other wardrobe people I'd met in LA, she had insane fashion sense. Today, her jet black hair was spiked straight up, and she had on ankle boots, leggings, shorts, and a long sleeve shirt under a tank top, all in varying shades of pink. She looked like a fairy without wings. "I'm meeting with a client," I said. "Anybody cool?" she asked. I rolled my eyes. "Like that would happen." Moss nodded her understanding of my lowly off-lister's position. "Where's the meet?" she asked. "At her home in Hancock Park," I said. Moss didn't even blink. "Some rich old lady," she said, and disappeared into the clothing racks. Inside of 4 minutes, she reappeared and presented me with a black, totally accessorized Michael Kors business suit. I slipped into one of the dressing rooms and changed. "You nailed it, as usual," I said, as I came out and zipped my own clothes into the garment bag. Moss took the bag and had me do a quick spin. "Epic," she declared. I grabbed my things and headed to the parking garage. The car the valet brought around for me was another BMW 5 Series. I punched the client's address into the GPS and headed west on Wilshire Boulevard. Was this awesome or what? Here I was, dressed in a designer suit, complete with expensive accessories, driving a luxury automobile along one of the most well-known streets in one of the world's most fabulous cities. I love LA. Of course, even a luxury automobile could get caught in traffic, especially on one of the most well-known streets in one of the world's most fabulous cities. As so often happens in LA, traffic had come to a complete stop for no obvious reason. I took the opportunity to skim the portfolio the tech and the investigations department had compiled for Andy. It was the hard copy. Some clients, mostly older ones, preferred seeing us writing on paper instead of pecking on our phones or tablets. Fisher Joyce wouldn't dream of having an employee visit a client without knowing just who they were dealing with. The info the techs compiled came from public records and a few shadier sources I couldn't wait to learn about when I got to work there. unless the client had previous business with the company. From the thin file Andy had given me, it appeared this client was a first-timer. I saw that this case file had been compiled by Meredith Durant. I'd met her in the break room shortly after I'd started at Fisher Joyce, and we hit it off right away. She was a lot like me. Early 20s, single and struggling with money, dating, and the always present questions about the future. Meredith was fashion challenged, so I'd given her advice on what to wear on occasion. I'd told her I wanted to work in the investigations department, so she gave me a heads up on the latest rumors, poor performance reviews, and possible job openings. According to the file Meredith had prepared, the woman with the missing dog was one Barbara Walker Pierce, the old-school, old-money widow of an investment banker who spent her time and considerable wealth on philanthropic endeavors, and, no doubt, lavishing unseemly amounts of money on her now-missing dog. Traffic cleared, and I continued down Wilshire, then turned onto June Street and Hancock Park. This section of L.A. had been developed in the 1920s by an oil-drilling family who sold lots around the grounds of a private golf club on which huge, architecturally distinctive homes had been built. The term architecturally distinctive homes being code for mansions. I'd been to this section of town once before on a movie shoot when Brittany and I had worked as extras. The production company had rented a house that the owners had inherited but couldn't afford to maintain, and they had used the property's front lawn as the setting of a park. I cruised down June Street past magnificent homes, all surrounded by mature, well-tended landscaping, until my GPS announced that I'd arrived at my destination. I pulled into the driveway and sat there for a couple of minutes, reading the rest of Barbara Walker Pierce's file. It was mostly info on her general background, her maiden name, birth date, kids. Her known associates read like a who's who list of other wealthy philanthropic families in Los Angeles. The only thing that jumped out at me was that this property wasn't Mrs. Walker Pierce's home. The owner of record was one Edith Bagley. Meredith hadn't taken the next step of identifying the Bagley woman or her connection to our new client. I guess there's only so much background needed for a missing dog. The house was a white stucco Spanish style, easily worth the $10.5 million estimated in the file. A Mercedes S-Class sedan that went for over $100,000. I know cars, thanks to my uncles, their car lot, and their love of automobiles in general, sat next to me in the driveway. Everything about the house and the neighborhood indicated the residents enjoyed great wealth and probably had for generations. I walked up the brick path to the low-rise tile steps. The double front doors were intricately carved dark wood. One of them had a mail slot. I rang the bell. After a minute or so, I heard the clacking of heels on tile inside. The door opened. I expected to be greeted by a servant in a uniform and was surprised to see Barbara Walker Pierce instead. She looked pretty much like the photo I'd seen in her file, medium height and build, mid-50s, short graying hair, with a look of polished sophistication befitting a woman of her standing. "Hello, Mrs. Walker Pierce," I said. "I'm Hollis Brannigan from Fisher Joyce." I held out my business card, but she didn't take it. She just stood there, holding on to the door, looking me up and down, trying to determine, I suppose, my worthiness to help her find her missing dog. Maybe she'd expected me to roll up in an armored vehicle, accompanied by a team of professional dog trackers ready to swarm the neighborhood. I didn't know. I stood there, waiting. Finally, she took my business card and stared at it. Since all it stated was my name, the company's name, and contact info, I didn't know exactly what she expected to glean from the long in-depth study she was giving it. I didn't say anything, just kept standing there and waiting. "You're an investigator, Ms. Brannigan?" she asked, though her tone suggested she doubted it. "Yes, I am," I said, and gave her my most confident smile. "Experienced,"
she asked.
I requested someone with experience.
I wasn't sure exactly how much experience Mrs. Walker Pierce thought was necessary.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?